What do you do if you are a high school dropout from Harlem? Well, if you are Richard Carmona, you join the Army Special Forces as a Green Beret and medic. You earn 2 Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star. You get an Associate of Arts degree in nursing, a Bachelor of Science degree in biology and chemistry, and a medical degree from the University of California, San Francisco, where, by the way, he was awarded the prestigious gold-headed cane as a top graduate at the time. You then go on to become the medical director of the Pima County's Police and Fire Department, where you also serve as a peace officer leader for the SWAT division and as deputy sheriff for the county. If that's not enough, you become a vice admiral in the Public Health Services Commission Corps and serve as the 17th Surgeon General of the United States. Of course, that's what all high school dropouts do, isn't it? Dr. Carmona is now the chief of innovation at Canyon Ranch and a professor of medicine at the University of Arizona, where he is also in charge of the university's COVID-19 response. I am so looking forward to speaking with Dr. Carmona today. So let's get the conversation started. Colin Milner Rethinks Aging with Dr. Richard Carmona. Welcome to the show, Rich. Let's start with a simple question. Is our DNA our destiny?
You know, it's a great question, Colin, and it's been one that's been debated for some time. But recent science tells us not so. And it is a complex answer, but I think I can simplify it. The DNA, which is the genetic material that you get passed from your mom and dad, that makes you who you are. And usually, as you grow, you look at those two parents and you think, I'm not anything like them, and you deny it. And then about the time you're middle age, you go, gosh, I'm just like them. What you get from them is the startup software for your body. And then the decisions you make through life get to code and recode those genes, which are your genetic material. They're the software packages that you inherit, okay? And so the relationships you have, the air you breathe, the food you eat, the exercise you do or don't do, all have what's called epigenetic inputs. And they turn your genes on or off and can make you healthy or can make you sick. So you get to determine probably 75, 80% of who you are by continuing to reprogram the genetic material that you started with.
So now that we actually know this, how are we applying this knowledge?
It's a great question. And I think that what we're doing is educating mostly. When I was a young doctor going through school, they kind of wrote off the seniors back then because they was thought, well, the old dog's not going to learn new tricks. Let's not spend a whole lot of time there. And you thought that once you got some dementia, once you maybe had Alzheimer's, once you had physical changes, that they would be irreversible. And now we find that is absolutely 100% wrong. That you can continue to learn through life. You can continue, even if you have disease, to be better. And so the idea that we've been trying to move forward in some of my publications and working with my colleagues is that your hardware is what you've got. Your brain is what it is. But the good news is you can continue to reprogram that throughout life. And the brain is a central control center that does everything else. It affects your immune system. It affects your muscular strength. It affects your thinking. So now with this new understanding, it's up to us to be able to educate the public that when you're 60, when you're 70, if you have, as a lot of Americans do, have 2 or 3 chronic diseases, it doesn't mean you have to live with them. Much of hypertension is what's called essential hypertension, that if you lost some weight and gave your heart some exercise and integrated your lifestyle practices, you might be able to even come off that medication. If you have type 2 diabetes, a lot of it is because we gain weight, get sedentary, eat the wrong foods. You can reprogram those genes as well. I think it's fascinating, but it is also opening up doors to a new world where you can live younger, happier, longer, stronger, and cheaper.
However, it still comes down to people changing their behaviors to modify their genes, doesn't it?
Yes, there's no question, Colin.
How do we help people, or people help themselves, to change their behaviors?
We have a better understanding of how we learn. And the ultimate equation is for us who have the scientific understanding, how do we take the most complex science the world has ever known, translate it in a culturally competent, health literate manner to do one thing only, effect sustainable behavioral change? That's it, what you just said. Walk a little more. Don't eat that, eat this. Be nice to others. Give somebody a hug once in a while. All those simple things that we would take for granted in the past have actually been shown to be very important and variables that contribute to your health, as well as practices we used to call complementary. I grew up in a typical traditional Western medical school, and they were very open, but it was pretty much a body of knowledge that was already accepted. And yet there was a world out there where people had practiced different things for thousands of years. Meditation, mindfulness, acupuncture, Ayurvedic medicine. And we're finding that those things indeed do work in some cases, not all, but we study that now and we're finding out. So those are all epigenetic inputs. And our goal now is to make those healthy decisions or epigenetic inputs so that we can optimize our health and wellness through life to keep the cost of care down, quality of life up.
I would say one of the ways of keeping costs down is to become more precise with our recommendations. The simple fact is actually driving the concept of precision health, personalized wellness, and person-centered healthcare. Can you tell us a little bit about where we are today with respect to all of this and where you see this whole movement actually heading?
We are in our infancy today as it relates to personalized care, personalized health, personalized public health, because we've gone from a macro level. And so, Colin, you'll remember when we were kids, your grandma probably told you, go out and play, be nice to other people, eat your greens, okay? I can tell you now that grandma was right, but I can tell you on a molecular level. She didn't know the molecules, she didn't know DNA, but she was right just intuitively. And so we know today that all of those things actually are helping us to better understand these epigenetic inputs. And so the question you ask where we are, we're in our infancy, because right now with the Human Genome Project, which was rolled out about 2003, and our understanding of the genetics, the heritable information that you receive from your parents, and that how it's related to disease and how it's related to health. So when we understand that and we understand how the genes work, then it's very important that we understand what are the inputs that we can use to optimize the software that we are creating. So I use the term software because it is what you're really doing. The actions you take or don't take are coding those genes, which is your software package that's building upon what you got from your parents. So we're in our infancy. As we move forward, we'll be able to more precisely say, based on your genetic fingerprint, what foods maybe work better for you? What medication works better for you? How is exercise? How does mindfulness? All of these things, how do they affect your genome? We're all going to be different. So we're kind of at a macro level now, but we're gaining more and more information as we unravel the complications of the human genome and relate it to health and to disease.
I assume that with all of these new tools that we have that are also able to aggregate large sums of data in a very short period of time, that we're actually going to become much more detailed in the prescription that we offer our customers for living a well life. Is that correct?
So being able to aggregate large amounts of data that normally would have taken years to compute now gets done in seconds. So for instance, when you're looking at the Human Genome Project and the millions of combinations and permutations of genes working together, it's almost impossible to decipher that in your lifetime without these very fast computers that are out there now. So as more of that data comes in and more relationships are built globally among scientists, when they're identifying a disease and they look at the genetic fingerprint that's associated with a cancer, with a leukemia, and so on, if you were just doing a few patients, it'd be difficult. But when you have the ability to aggregate data from all over the world and now process it so that you have a machine that does it, you teach the machine with the software how to learn. So you have machine learning. The machine gets better at processing as it's learning. Then you aggregate that data and you get into what's called artificial intelligence. That computer's thinking like your brain and just a lot faster. And then it can sort all that information and come out with specific information that helps you make better decisions based on all of that aggregated data. So whether it's the human genome or whether it's just activities, asking a question, well, 70-year-olds do this kind of activity. How many like it? How many don't like it? So something macro, but you can also get very micro and look at certain genes and how they act in certain environments and look at hundreds of millions of those aggregated around the world and then be able to even make cuts like, well, tell me, what does the genome look like in, let's say, for an example, Germans in Germany versus the Germans living in the United States, or Hispanics in Spain versus Hispanics in Puerto Rico. And you could start to do these cuts to look at what the environmental influences are. So there's so much information coming in now that will allow us to be more precise, and it's leading to new fields, nutrigenomics. So in nutrigenomics, we're starting to learn now that certain foods are good for some people and not for others. Pharmacogenomics, same thing. Some drugs will work well in some people and others not. There's other genomics that are evolving too, with mental health, psychogenomics, and others, as we get to understand the genetic basis of mental illness, for instance. So it really is a fantastic new world that is moving toward true precision health and medicine.
Do you see this becoming part of the curriculum in schools?
Really interesting question. First of all, the science that I see in my children and grandchildren when I was their age was science fiction, and now it's here. If I was only able to practice as a physician today with the information I got in medical school decades ago, I would be irrelevant. The point being that the science is going very, very fast, and that as we move forward and be able to accumulate this information, it will be better for all of us in society because we'll be able to make better decisions. Doctors will be able to give you better advice. Even at the grammar school level now, kids are learning about genetics. When I was in school, even in medical school, the discussion was about something called the double helix and DNA. That was it. Now we have thousands and thousands of applications, better understanding in just a few decades, and that's going to continue to grow. So the youngsters today are learning that. I know that my granddaughter, who's 14 years old, who can program a computer, who understands artificial intelligence, who understands the power of aggregating data and what's called predictive analytics to get the answers, she also has studied in biology classes what we're talking about right now, and understanding that lifestyle choices make a difference in how your genes function. That's in junior high school. So it's changing. The kids are growing up understanding this. Seniors pick it up later on, and like some of the articles that I've written and you and I've seen in ICAA talk about that. But this becomes part of the culture of the youngsters today. They understand, and they're asking questions about the cereals they eat, the food they eat, the drinks. How does that affect my genes? We didn't ask those questions when we were kids. We didn't know what a gene was, but the kids today understand that. So very different world. They're the ones that are going to be driving this forward.
It's going to be really interesting to see the adoption of this approach and, of course, the tools that are being developed to support this that will also enable us to become more responsible for our health and wellness. An example of this would be wearables.
We don't want to have a world where we entirely depend on a practitioner to tell us what to do. But with the wearables, like you said, where I can be tracking data, get downloads every day of how many steps I walk, what my oxygen level is, what my glucose level is. If I know that information, then the idea is if we've educated the public enough, I can take appropriate action to be able to deal with that. Remember in the old days, if you had type 2 diabetes, you're sticking yourself all the time for glucose levels and things. Now you put a little patch on it, you have a wearable and it tells you your glucose all the time. And your app on your phone will send you signals that your glucose is too low or it's too high and you take appropriate action. So all of those things are very positive, and it helps to put us in control of our own destiny.
Do you believe being able to see feedback at any moment of the day will inspire and engage more people to manage their health and well-being?
Well, in fact, Colin, there's a new field that's rapidly growing called digital health, where through wearables, you can monitor all of your body parameters, but your doctor can. And basically, a company I'm working with now, for instance, is singled out diabetics, which is huge disease and economic burden in our nation. And most is type 2 diabetes, which is preventable. But to be able to monitor your status as it relates to your glucose and hemoglobin A1C, which are measures of how well you're controlling your glucose. But to give you that information after training you and then effect sustainable behavioral change, because if you don't change that number, you're going to end up in the hospital, you're going to get sick, it'll accelerate a heart disease and hypertension and so on. And so some of the early studies are showing that that information alone is enough to inspire people to change behaviors, because they don't have to wait for the annual physical. They get it every morning. They get an update that says, this is not looking good. Walk a little more, lose a little weight, do the following. That's already there. Digital health is growing very, very quickly in the health space.
So are healthcare practitioners actually keeping up with new technology?
That's a great question. The science is evolving so quickly that you really have to spend time, because once you leave medical school, every year you're becoming more irrelevant unless you're staying up with the science, because it's moving so quickly. So I think most doctors are, because they realize it becomes an adjunct to their care. And of course, this is protected information, so the patient would have to give permission to the doctor to reach in. And the other thing the doctor can do is, on your app, can set parameters. In other words, if your glucose level hits this high, I will be notified that your glucose is too high or too low, or your blood pressure, or your pulse rate, or your oxygen level. So the doctor doesn't have to see you, but he'll get a note that something's wrong and then can contact you. You'll know as well, so you can take appropriate action. It's creating a different integrative system, which puts more control with the patient, educates the patient. And just like when you get on an app with people, and you've seen this where people sign up and do apps for counting steps, they start competing whether they know it or not. They start looking at their friends. Oh, Joe did 6,000. I'm going to do 7,000. Okay. That's good, because there is that natural competitiveness in us. And so we're starting to see, what are the ways that we can inspire people to make better, healthy choices? Building communities around your patients where information can be shared anonymously. My 100 patients are sharing how many steps they're walking a day, or who has the lowest blood pressure, who has the best glucose control. These are all being sourced now to find out how we can continue to inspire people. And we know that we tend to be competitive. You know, you see your friends doing more, you want to do more, and so on. That's what's evolving anyway now, Colin.
So let me ask you to step back for a second and actually put on your Surgeon General hat. With the new technologies available now, how would you change the current healthcare system?
Well, first, let me say, we don't have a healthcare system. It's a sick care system. Okay, so let's get rid of that myth. And why I say that is, we're spending about 19% or so of our gross domestic product a year, over $3 trillion a year. And when you look at what we spend it on, 3/4, 75 cents, 80 cents of every dollar is spent on chronic diseases that we cause by being sedentary, gaining weight, no exercise, engaging in high-risk activities. And so people are going to get sick anyway, body parts wear out, and that's not what I'm referring to. I'm referring to the things that we impose on ourselves because of our poor behaviors. And that takes away from quality of life. To get to a real health system, we have to be able to have a structure that rewards the practitioner for keeping you healthy, rewards you for staying healthy and keeping costs down, and it improves your quality and quantity of life. But right now, the system goes back to the English. That's the system we used at the beginning of our country. And since that time, we've continued to put patches on it. And we get up into the modern age and we have Medicare and Medicaid and all of the support programs and HMOs. And we just keep putting Band-Aids on this. It's a very convoluted, complex system that the average person has no way of understanding. And you have navigators now that help you get through your own system because it's just too complicated. Do I pay for this? Do I need a copay? I don't understand. Well, just go online. Well, you know, a lot of people don't go online. Not everybody has a computer. And they try and go online, they get lost online because as soon as you come online, you get hit with 100 messages that have nothing to do with what you want. And you're not sure what to believe. The important thing here is that as we're moving forward, your question becomes very important. What should the health system of the future look like? Not a sick care system, which is what we have. And yeah, we are the best in the world. We have best surgery, best drugs, drives the economy. That's a given. But if you want a real health system, the value proposition has to be optimizing your health throughout the lifespan, from birth to 80s, 90s, 100s, whenever you live. And right now, most of the revenue is generated by making you well after you get sick.
That's always going to be a problem, isn't it?
Well, always now, but I hope in the future that if for no other reason we can't afford the trajectory we're on, the debt we're transferring to our kids, the disease and economic burden that is preventable is astronomical. And I think back, and I'll paraphrase Winston Churchill, who said, "I love Americans. They always do the right thing eventually." And we're going toward eventually now because we can't afford anything else. So slowly, we're going to see changes that are rewarding, optimizing health and wellness. Our life expectancy has increased. At 1900, we were living to about 48 years. We've almost doubled that now, well into the 80s, depending on where you live in the world and the nation. But even if you say 80, the problem is that once you hit your 50s and 60s, the average American has several chronic diseases, is on several medications, and most of that's preventable for most people. Hypertension, hyperlipidemias, diabetes. There are good people that get bad diseases. That's not their fault, that the genes weren't working right and you end up with something. But for the most part, most of the disease we see is largely preventable.
As I understand it, if we live long enough, are we actually going to have some form of health issue anyway?
The body parts wear out, but if you can learn how to optimize, you can live longer. You know, as you know, Colin, in many of the polls that have been done with seniors and how long do you want to live, you ask a 70-year-old, how do you define old? It's usually the generation in front of you, the 80-year-olds. If you ask the 80-year-old, it's the 90-year-old. And so the challenge, of course, is you want to live longer, younger, healthier, happier, and cheaper. And what we are actually finding is those last 10 or 20 years of life are sometimes pretty painful for people. Arthritis, back pain, falls, osteoporosis, and hypertension, hyperlipidemia, disease, cardiac disease. Yet a lot of those would be preventable if we can get back into childhood and start optimizing health all the way through. Now, eventually, the body parts are going to wear out, but at least you can be functional longer, okay, even though you'll slow down a little, rather than, as we see today, so many people who have to walk with an oxygen tank or can't walk too far or can't do the activities of daily living because they've worn out those parts too fast or accelerated chronic disease that was largely preventable.
I'm curious, how does the environment around us impact all of this?
Environment is very important. The air we breathe, and I'm going to give you a broader environment. It's not only the air we breathe, but the built environment where we live. Everything from the color of the walls, from the air circulation in the buildings, the relationships you have or don't have, all of those have incremental value as your value. Because I'm looking at environment, is it everything that touches you? Every epigenetic input, air, water, food, relationships. You might be doing well with air and food, but you live in a crummy building that has bad ventilation, okay? And there's toxic chemicals falling off because there's asbestos that you didn't know about. That's part environment. On the other hand, if you optimize all of those things, but you have no relationships, you don't have a girlfriend, a boyfriend, you don't have children, you don't have people that love you or you love them, then that's part of your environment too, because it is missing and it becomes deleterious. So when I look at environment for a person, it's everything, any and all epigenetic inputs that you have, starting with the external, the sun, the moon, the stars, the sky, the sounds, where you live, the built environment is becoming much more important now. And then the decisions you make, which are the additional epigenetic inputs, all of those have incremental value to optimizing your health.
So everything that we're talking about really comes back to the decisions we make. What do you say to those who say, I don't have a choice given my income level?
Well, that's a good one too, Colin, because in some cases it is true. We know there are great health disparities in the nation. We know that there are people who don't have the means to buy fruits and vegetables every day, buy a good fish or another good protein source. And so we recognize that the challenges before us become quite complex. We know what everybody needs in a perfect world, but if you can't access good food, education, and so on, your health disparities will be manifest. And we see it now, for instance, in COVID. The COVID that is disproportionately affecting, for instance, people of color. And a lot of that is because they're socioeconomically disadvantaged, they're overweight, and it puts them at greater risk. So you see the mortality and morbidity from COVID in people of color higher. In general, the social determinants of health, where you live, your education level, your parents' education level, where you work, your relationships, all of those social things have a determinative input as to how healthy or sick you will be. And the neighborhood you live in, again, back to environment, if there's not a store where you can buy healthy food, or if you don't have the money to get it, and hence we have a lot of support programs in state and federal government that help with that. But nevertheless, it becomes a barrier to optimizing health. And in our seniors, as you well know, Colin, when you are on several medications, you're on a fixed income, Social Security, maybe a little retirement, and we see often that our seniors will divide their medicine in half because they can't afford it. They will only eat one meal a day. Maybe it's Meals on Wheels that comes to the house. And in some cases, we've even seen them eating animal food to be able to get by, you know, and feed their animal. So these are heartbreaking things when we see them, that you want those last years of life to be filled with dignity and pride and loving relationships. But the reality is it isn't always there.
Will we actually be able to afford all of these new technologies that promise to help us live, well, better longer?
Well, I think some of that has been answered already, because if you walk around the poorest neighborhoods, everybody's got an iPhone or some platform. And most people are computer literate, even though they may be socially and economically disadvantaged. Not all, but some. And so the real issue is, as we look at the cost curve and the mounting disease and economic burden, we must do something to flatten that curve. Otherwise, what will happen is we will continue to be divided into the rich and the poor. And that's not what we want. And so if we are able to get people to understand that they can control some of their health, that we put in place the correct organizational structure for access to health care, education, training to make better decisions, improve the quality of life, reduce the cost of care across the board, then there is more money available. But if the cost curve continues to go up at the rate it's going, then you're right. That is something we need to worry about, that we will have a society that is divided, very unlike the democracy that we have chosen to try and create in this 245-year experiment called democracy. As is joked about sometimes, that we're all created equal, but it appears some of us are more equal than others. Those are the realities today, and this is the best place in the world to live in America. It's the place where people risk their lives to come, as opposed to many other places in the world. But yet we are quite imperfect, and the democracy is still being formed and reformed. And we've had a tough time the last few years with all of the events that have occurred, and democracy has been challenged. But it is important that all of us make sure that everybody has opportunity. Everybody doesn't have to be a millionaire, but everybody should have an opportunity to appreciate their fullest potential, to get a job, to have a family, to have a home or an apartment someplace, and where you feel a purpose of contributing in life, whatever that may be. And right now, we're struggling because of the poverty levels that are exacerbated by COVID, the disease and economic burden that is disproportionately placed on people of color. And so hopefully when we come out of this, we can continue to correct and perfect that 245-year-old experiment called democracy.
So how important is one's health to achieving the American dream?
Probably the smartest thing I can say in a couple of words is that health is the greatest wealth. Because no matter how much money you have, if you're sickly, if you're depressed, if you're anything negative, the money doesn't help you. On the other hand, if you are in the lowest socioeconomic level, but you're happy, your kids are eating, you have a job, they get to go to Disneyland with you once a year, you're probably better off there. So health and wealth, I know many people of means that are not happy for a whole host of reasons. But I think that it's important as a nation that we all make sure that there is equitable opportunity, not equitable distribution of wealth, but equitable opportunity for everybody to take a chance. And everybody has access to health care. Everybody can get a good education or trade school to get them prepared to function in society. Right now, we're struggling and COVID has made it worse. all of us who've had the privilege to do well in society need to remember how to pay it back and make sure you bring that forward. I'm afflicted with that because I came from a poor immigrant family, and I was homeless for a while as a kid, dropped out of high school, and went in the Army when I was 17. And that saved me. And it gave me a wealth of opportunity that I capitalized on throughout my life. Even though I failed many times, I always knew when I needed to keep fighting to move forward. And I hope that everybody has that opportunity like I had to be able to advance based on your work ethic and based on your commitment. And irregardless of your gender or ethnicity, sex, doesn't make a difference. But that's what America should be. I think now on the other end too, we have a lot of our seniors that are struggling. Loneliness, as you know, a great deal of women last longer than their significant others, and they're lonely and they lose connections with family. And as you know, Colin, the greatest potentiator of cognitive decline and physical decline is loneliness. And even in Britain, you probably know now they have a minister of loneliness because they recognize the impact that that is having on the seniors in their country. And they're doing everything they can to create communities and keep people connected, give them a purpose for life. So we've got some challenges before us, but they're not insurmountable. We just need to pull together and not be divided by this hyperpartisan politics and conspiracy theories that are as toxic as the virus itself.
Well, thank you very much for that, Rich. It was great to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Colin. I want to give you a shout out, too, for all your leadership and work you do on active aging, because you connect the world around the aging issues, and you and the ICAA have really become the aggregator of all that good information that you share with all our seniors. So thank you so much.
So what did we learn from our conversation with Dr. Richard Carmona? Here's my top 10 list. Number one. Our DNA is not our destiny. Our lifestyle choices, however, may well be. Number two, no matter whether in junior high or retiring, understanding how our genes work will be vital to achieving long-term health and well-being. Number three, genes are like software programs. You can reprogram your software with epigenetic inputs, which turn genes on or off, making us ill or well. These inputs are driven by everything from the air we breathe to the food we eat. Change your environments, behaviors, and choices, and you change how your software is programmed. Number four, everything we engage with is part of our environment. We need to manage our environments and the way we interact with them, from the air we breathe to the food we eat to where we live. All of this impacts how well we live. Number five, we don't want to have a world where we are entirely dependent on a practitioner to tell us what to do. We need to use technology to drive self-care through, actually, well, you guessed it, better informed health decisions and outcomes. How are we going to do that? Well, technology aggregates and translates data instantly, helping us to make health management decisions that are more precise and in the moment. Number six, personalized care, personalized health, and person-centered public health care. These are all in their infancy. But the one thing that we do know is that based on our genetic fingerprint, we are beginning to be able to tell what food people may be actually able to eat that is better for them, what medications work better for them, how to exercise. All of these different elements are resulting in new fields such as nutrigenomics and psychogenomics, and the future will be all about how we embrace these and utilize these to gain better health and well-being over the long run. Number seven, for society to benefit from personalized health and wellness, healthcare practitioners need to remain relevant and effective by embracing and understanding these new technologies. Number eight, this one will blow your mind. 75 to 80 cents of every healthcare dollar is spent on chronic diseases that we cause. How do we cause this? By being sedentary, gaining weight, not exercising, and engaging in high-risk activities. Wow, Nothing else you can say. Number 9, we don't have a healthcare system. It's a sick care system. To get a real health system, we have to be able to have a structure that rewards a practitioner for keeping us healthy, rewards us for staying healthy and keeping costs down, and altogether improves our quality of life and quantity of life. Number 10, the American dream is driven by achieving, you got it, good health and well-being over our life course. Well, that's what we learned today from Dr. Richard Carmona. If you have any comments on the show or suggestions, please send me an email at colinmilner@rethinkaging.co. I also hope you choose to share this podcast and social media with those who could benefit from it. Our hashtag is RethinkAging. I'd like to also take a moment to thank each and every one of you for joining in today and encourage you to tune in for our next podcast, as my guest will be Dr. Kristen Tugman. Until then, much success.